Good evening. I invite you to be opening your Bibles tonight. 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. While you're getting settled in there this evening, please be opening your Bibles there. We'll be reading from there in just a moment. 1 John 2. Good to see you tonight. Glad that you are here. To our visitors, thank you for the encouragement and gift of your presence. And we do have on this holiday weekend have visitors who are passing through. Some who weren't here this morning but are here tonight. Some are here this morning, gone tonight. Nature of a holiday weekend, but we're thankful for all those who are traveling and passing through. If you're from the community and you're visiting with us tonight, we're especially excited that you're here because that means you can make this a regular thing. We'd love to talk with you. Any questions, comments, concerns you have about what we're doing here, how we worship God, how we study His Word, we'd like nothing better than to talk with you about that. Feel free to say something to somebody before you leave tonight, or if you'd rather, leave a visitor's card behind. There's a light blue card in a visitor's packet that's found at all three doors of the auditorium, and you can leave behind some information, maybe even a question, and we'd be happy to get back in touch with you at the time of your convenience. We're glad that you're here tonight, though. 1 John chapter 2 in your Bible. We have been doing an occasional series on the way the Bible describes sin through the summer, and especially 1 John chapter 2, John's unique description thereof, of sin. 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 15, John said this. He said, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." Don't love the world, John says. It doesn't mean there don't love people. Don't love people who are stuck in sin, trapped in misery. That's not what John's talking about. The world is just the idea of an ordering system, a way of doing reality. There's mankind's counterfeit version of reality, steeped in sin, and there's God's true view of what the world really is. There's one way of doing life and that's of man, and there's another way of doing life that's of God. The way of doing life per man's values and desires and wants. Oh, that's what John means by the world. He says, don't love that. Don't love the counterfeit reality that mankind has created and called this true and real and sometimes even blasphemously beautiful. No, John says, do not love the world or the things in the world, because if you love this reality, if you love mankind's counterfeit, the love of God is not in you. No, for all is in the world, and he goes on to list the lust of the flesh, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life. These things are not from the Father, but from the world. And the world, this way of doing reality, what we so often live in and think is real, mankind's counterfeit, the world is passing away along with its desires, its lusts, the things that it craves and values most. Oh, that's passing away, John says. But whoever does the will of God, whoever accepts God's version and vision of reality, that one abides forever. And so says John. We talked a couple of weeks ago. We talked about the lust of the flesh. We talked about what the Apostle John would have meant by that, the idea of the lust of the flesh, the most animalistic and base desires that come from within us. There is something about the fact that we are souls that have bodies, that we are, in a sense, incarnate, that we are spiritual beings who have a physical side. And there's something that uniquely comes through the fact that we are incarnate, that we have bodies. There's an avenue in which sin can try to get its hooks, its snares into us. The idea simply of the fact that whether it's gluttony to sexual satisfaction illicitly done, there's something about being in the body. In certain sense, it can only be committed with the body and through the body. And so that's one avenue in which sin tries to get us. We talk about the nature of lust in general and really, what is lust? Remember, we talked especially there about James chapter 1 a little bit. And James 1, beginning of verse 13, remember there James had written, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. Because God cannot be tempted with evil, and God himself tempts no one." So where does temptation come from? Well, each person is tempted, James says, when each person is lured away and enticed by what? By his own desire. God doesn't tempt. Where does the temptation come from? It comes from within me. Two different people see the same thing. We recognize this in daily life. We've talked about this before. We see this in daily life. Two different people can pass by a lost dollar bill on the street. One person's tempted to pick it up and keep it. One person isn't. It's not the dollar's fault one way or the other. Where does the temptation come from? Some of us are greedy in covetousness more than others. But all of us have weaknesses. All of us have ways in which we can be led to sin. What James says, each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. Sin, when it's fully grown, sin brings forth death. When we're talking about lust or desire here, we're talking especially what James means is lust or desire that is fundamentally disordered. We want the wrong things. We want illicit gain. We want illicit sexual satisfaction. We want things that maybe come in a sense, quote unquote, naturally through the body or naturally in this life, but they are disordered desires not fit for beings who will live eternally and were created to live eternally. Their desires are distorted. And James says, don't you ever blame God for the fact that you're tempted to sin. Where did the desire for this illicit satisfaction, where did the desire for this illicit gain, where does the illicit desire come from? It's from inside me. I'm the one whose wants and desires are broken and disordered, and the problem therefore lies within me. So John comes along and he basically says, be careful what you desire. Be careful what you want. Do not love the world or the things that are in the world, John says. You can choose what you love. You can choose what you want. Don't love the lust of the flesh. We talked about it already. But tonight, we want to talk about the desires of the eyes. Desires of the eyes, the lust of the eyes. Whereas the lust of the flesh highlights desires and instincts and impulses that come from within us, bodily appetites or emotional responses that can become the occasions for sin when we allow them to animalistically control us in the name of instinct. The lust of the eyes in particular focus on how things external to us come to be inside us, in our heart, festering and influencing us and leading us to sin. Indeed, there's something fundamental about the eye as the window to the soul. You remember the story back when God made the world and all was right and all was good and all was perfect? Genesis chapter 3, the serpent shows up to have a conversation in the garden, and he's talking with the woman, and he says to the woman near the end of his first round of temptation with her, he says, for God knows, speaking of the forbidden fruit, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. Your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Your eyes will be opened. You can see the way God sees. You can evaluate rightly and well the way God evaluates. And the fundamental temptation of humanity at the beginning was, you can see differently. I can change your eyes. I can give you a vision you haven't seen before. I can alter how you see reality. And so when the woman, the text says, saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. But it was a delight to the eyes. She listened to what Satan had said. She bought into what he was offering. And the lust of the eyes in particular is a focus on how things external to us can have an influence within us. The old song that we sing with our children, oh, be careful, little eye, what you see, has an immense amount of wisdom in it. Sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes we teach our children better than we know. And sometimes there is more wisdom in our childish songs and things than we sometimes realize. When it comes to the lust of the eyes in the Bible, the eye really is a metaphor. Again, it's a metaphor for how things external to us come to be inside us, how the world's stimuli come to be inside of us. The eye as a metaphor. And it works on several levels in the Bible, the eye as a metaphor. The eye is as spiritual insight, or tragically, the lack thereof. The eye is being able to see right and well, or not being able to see at all. Throughout the Bible, blindness is a metaphor for spiritual deadness, for obliviousness, for those who can't see really, or those who are blind really. Regardless of whether their physical eyes work or not, those who can't see the way God sees, who don't desire what God desires, are in fact blind. And it's a hard thing sometimes to see how blind we really are. That's one of the things the Bible tells us. I love the story of the gentleman one day who's driving home after work. It's been a long, hard day. He's exhausted. He gets a frantic phone call from his wife, though, as he's going down the highway. Honey, she says, please be careful while you're driving. I'm watching the TV and there's some maniac on the highway going the wrong way. And he says, just one maniac. There's hundreds of them. That's the problem with seeing but not seeing sometimes. In the Bible, that's exactly how it works. That's exactly the warning the Bible offers us. Jesus in Matthew 13, in verse 13, he says this. He says, this is why I speak in parables. I speak to them in parables because seeing they do not see. Hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. Eventually he goes on to say, because this people's heart has grown dull. And with their ears, they can barely hear, and their eyes, they have closed. It's a willful thing. They don't want to see, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Like one of my favorite stories in all the Gospels, a story that the way the miracle itself unfolds is meant to be a rank illustration of who really sees and who doesn't. John chapter 9, remember the story of the man born blind? Jesus' disciples are trafficking one day in the temple, and they see a man born blind in its vicinity. The disciples ask the unfortunate question, whose fault is it that this man's blind? Whose sin, he or his parents, that he should suffer this fate? Jesus says, it's nobody's fault, but that the glory of God might be shown. And Jesus goes on to heal the blind man. But that creates a great controversy there among the religious leaders in the temple environment, because they basically don't want to confess Jesus is the Messiah. And yet a great miracle has taken place because this man was well known publicly among those who live and dwell around the temple as a man who was legitimately blind. And yet now he sees. How can this be? Who could have done this? And by what power would he have done it? And eventually, as the religious leaders first bring in the man, then they bring in his parents, and they bring him back in again for a second round, they say this to him in John 9, beginning of verse 29. They say, we know that God has spoken to Moses. We see that clearly. We can see this. We know this. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, and this man is Jesus, they can't even dare to say his name. They're so disgusted with him. This man over here, this Galilean peasant, this counterfeit, this fake, as for this man, who's not even worthy to have him be named in the same sentence with Moses, apparently. We know Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he's come from. The man born blind, answers. Why, this is an amazing thing, he says. You don't know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes? Wait a second. I'm blind, now I see, and you have no idea where this guy could have come from? We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anybody's a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world has began has it been heard that anybody opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were from God, he could do nothing. The blind man sees in more than one sense. If this man were not from God, he couldn't have done it. To which the religious leaders respond, you were born in utter sin and you would teach us? And they cast him out of the synagogue and out of the temple. Who really sees in that passage? Who sees and who's blind? It's a powerful thing the Bible does, reminding us that there are lots of people who go through life saying, I see, and never do. And there are those who go through life realizing that by the gift and grace of God, they finally see for the first time what's real and what's not. And so in the Bible, the eye becomes a metaphor for spiritual insight, for seeing God and for seeing Jesus and for seeing truth as it really is, or lack thereof, the blind eye. But the eye in the Bible is also a metaphor for our attitude towards material things, how we see the goods of this world. And so Jesus says in Matthew 6, and a familiar part in the Sermon on the Mount, and a familiar section within that sermon, in Matthew 6, he warns us, he says, do not lay up treasure for yourself on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. We know that part, but we always fly over the next couple of verses, which is sad because we lose something important about what Jesus goes on to say. Having said where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Jesus goes on to then say, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And then we come back to the section we always know. For no one can serve two masters. He will either hate the one and love the other, or will be devoted to the one and despise the other. But you can't serve God and money. See, we always fly over those two little verses, verse 22 and 23, in the middle of that there. We read before, we read after, we never read in between. Because Jesus is speaking in an idiom and a metaphor that we're not used to. What's he talking about? What he's basically saying is the eye, in a sense, is not just literally how you see things and it gets into your mind. I see a podium, I see people, and they're in my head now. I have an image of what's going on around me. The eye is also, in a sense, the evaluating object as well. It makes a decision about what to look at, what it wants to see, what it wants to have or possess. Eye is the lamp of the body, Jesus says. If your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. If your eye is healthy, you'll see well and your body will be healthy. But if you see poorly, you see covetously or greedily in the context here, it'll affect the rest of your life, Jesus says. It'll affect all of your body. See, throughout the Gospels, and really throughout the Bible, the eye is a metaphor, especially then, for our attitude towards material things, and whether we are generous or whether we are stingy and greedy. That's a common thing. Example of that, Matthew 20, verse 15, in this same gospel later on in Matthew 20, Jesus tells a story in which a wealthy man basically says to his critics in verse 15, am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? English Standard Version will say, or do you begrudge my generosity? But in the original, and even some of the more literal translations, it actually reads, is your eye evil because I am good? Do you have an evil eye because I am generous? Is your eye greedy, covetous, disappointed because I am generous with my things? In Deuteronomy 15 and verse 9, there in the Old Testament, God warns his people. See, every seventh year was to be a Sabbath year. And on the Sabbath year, God's people were supposed to relinquish the debts they had against one another. It's basically like your mortgage goes away every 7 years, which means there's no 30-year mortgages. There's only 7-year mortgages in Israel. Every seventh year, they go away. What would be the temptation for people who are in a position to lend to the needy if it was year number 6? Not to lend at all, because odds are I'm not going to get it back if I have to let the debt go in the seventh year. And yet God says in Deuteronomy 15 and verse 9, you take care lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart. And you say, the seventh year, the year of release of debts is near. And your eye look grudgingly on your poor brother and you give him nothing. And he cried to the Lord against you and you be guilty of sin. Literally in Hebrew, and your eye is evil toward your brother. Oh, be careful of the lies what you see. Oh, be careful of the lies how you see. And so it can be seen in our desire towards material things. Reality is that, as one writer put it, one's life-controlling perspective on money affects the spiritual condition of the whole self. That's really what Jesus meant in Matthew chapter 6. And it is a dangerous thing. Whether it was Eve in the garden who saw what she wanted and saw that it was beautiful, it was good, and she took it. Or whether it was Achan and Joshua who basically says, I saw among the spoil good clothes and good money, and I coveted them and took them. The evil eye in the Bible is always a pitfall for the people of God. The desire, ultimately, in a sense, have more than we need. And boy, is that a lesson for this day and this age in which we live. In Proverbs 27 and verse 20 there, one of my favorite Proverbs, there the wise man says, it says, Sheol, which is the Old Testament term basically for the grave. Sheol and Abaddon, destruction, death, destruction, annihilation. Sheol, the grave and destruction, death, are never satisfied. In other words, there's never a time until God stops history. There's never a time when death says, you know what, I've harvested enough souls. I think I'll stop now. There's never enough time when the grave of the ground is satisfied and said, no more bodies need to come here. Until God stops history, the ground is never satisfied. Death never says enough. So too, the wise man says, are the eyes of man never satisfied. Oh, be careful of the lies, what you see. And then there's the lust of the eyes, and it comes perhaps most quickly to our thinking in this sexualized age that we live in, the issue of sexual desire itself. Lust of the eyes naturally has sexual connotations. But I will tell you, throughout the Bible, there's a strong warning that our eyes get us into all sorts of sexual sin. It always starts with the eyes. Jesus, of course, in Matthew 5, most famously said, you've heard it said, you will not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent, he's already committed adultery in his heart. You look, you want, you desire. You may never commit the act, but in God's eyes, there's little difference in the sense that you have violated the other person and perhaps even commitment to your own spouse. No, but there's plenty of stories throughout the Bible that warn of this dynamic. The book of Judges tells the story of Samson. And the story of Samson, it's really interesting how much the text, this is a detail we often miss, because we just focus on how strong Samson was. That's Joel's favorite part. How strong Samson was, how destructive he could be. Joel really likes that part. But then ultimately, he's enslaved by the Philistines because he tells Delilah that if his hair is cut, he loses his strength, and he winds up with his eyes put out in a Philistine prison until at the end he prays to God, and God gives him strength one last time. He pulls the pillars down, annihilates the Philistines, and so he killed more in his death than he did in his life, the text says. Yet there's a sinister side to Samson's story and how he gets to where he does. See, early on in the story, in Judges 14, his first sexual desire being awakened, he goes to his mother and his father and wants a Philistine woman. And his mother and his father try to talk him out of it the first time. See, Delilah was not his first. And the first Philistine woman he wants, his mother and his father try to talk him out of it. They say to him in Judges 14, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all our people that you must go and take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistine? Samson, is there nobody here, no good Jewish girl you could be satisfied with?" And Samson said to his father, "Get her for me because she is right in my eyes." Yeah, there's Jewish girls, but this girl's hotter. This girl's better looking. She's right in my eyes. I want what my eyes want. She looks good to me. She is good in my eyes. In Judges 16, later on in the story, Samson goes into Gaza in the area of the Philistines. He saw a prostitute, and so he went into her, because after all, by this point, so we're starting to realize, Samson follows his eyes. Eventually, in Judges 16, verse 4, he loved a woman in the Valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. And so he keeps looking and he keeps seeing, he keeps chasing pagan woman. Why? Because she looks good to me is his argument. I don't know if you've ever noticed this or connected this or not, but what does it finally take for God to get Samson's full attention? His eyes have to be taken away. And then in Philistine prison, blinded once and for all, then he'll finally pray to God. But even then, even though Samson's physical eyes are gone, his spiritual eyes are no healthier. "Give me strength one last time," he asks God, "so that I may avenge my eyes against the Philistines. They took away from me one of the biggest satisfactions in my life, looking and lusting. I want to avenge my eyes." 2 Samuel 11, you remember the story. David, one late afternoon, gets up from his bed, walks on the roof of the king's house, and there he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. See, I love the way that verse tells that part of the story. David looks, he sees, but the fact that the text goes on to give the detail that she was very beautiful in 2 Samuel 11 tells me this, that it was not a glance David did. Because I can glance and I can see that there's a woman over there. I suppose in a glance I could probably tell if somebody's naked or not over there. But the only way I know that they're really, really good looking is when I keep staring at what I saw with the first glance. That's how I know David kept looking. A glance doesn't tell me she's gorgeous. Only a stare, a long stare, can do that. And so David moves from glance to stare to think to lust to adultery. Because this is how the sin of adultery starts. Because in your heart you've already sought and you've already imagined the experience apart from the action. Because your heart has not been loyal to your own spouse and you have in a sense robbed the other person of their dignity by seeing them that way in your mind's eye. And so the eye becomes a window to the soul in so many ways. It's how the world outside us gets inside us. And John says, be careful of the lust of the eyes. Be careful because your eyes and its desires and what it sees, what it wants to see, and how it processes what it sees is so easily disordered and disrupted. And so in the last couple of minutes that we have together this evening, let's talk very quickly, two quick observations about how to handle the lust of the eyes. Nothing new, nothing revolutionary in here, but it's just about reminding us all what we need to hear from time to time about this most powerful way of becoming like the world and becoming part of the world. Number one, we need to learn to make a covenant with our eyes. A covenant with our eyes. It's a great phrase. It's not mine. It's Job's, of all people. In Job chapter 31, there, Job basically, in affirming to his friends that, not that he's a perfect man, but that he's not been involved in any great, grievous sins, no large, hidden sins that he's been trying to sweep under the rug with God that in some way make him deserve what has happened to him, the loss of his wealth, the loss of his reputation, his health, his family and children, all the sufferings that have come upon Job. When Job begins to affirm his efforts at upright living. The first thing he says in Job 31, when he in a sense gives his resume of righteousness, the first thing he says in Job 31 and verse 1 is this: I have made a covenant with my eyes. I know how dangerous they are. I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? Later on in verse 9, he says, if my heart has been enticed toward a woman, and I have lain in wait at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down on her. Job says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. I don't wait until the moment of temptation, the moment when the lust of the eyes may make war against my soul. No, Job says, I've already sat down and stopped to think about this, that I'm going to be careful about what I look at and what I think about what I see. Job says, I'm going to be careful of what I look at and how long my eyes and my mind stay there. I think we get this in so many other spheres of life. I mean, take the financial sphere. You think about getting a new car, but your bank account, your checking book reminds you that you really can't afford one, or maybe you just don't really need one, and you know this deep down. But you think about getting a car, and so you begin to think about getting a car. When you are tempted to desire a new car, and you know you can't afford one, listen, you don't spend long staring at the car ads on TV, which are every other ad. And you don't spend your downtime on the internet looking at car deals at the local dealerships. And you sure don't go to a dealership and test drive one just because, just for fun. Because you know what happens if you keep staring at a new car on the TV and on the internet, and you go by the lot and you take those test drives? You know what's going to happen eventually? You're going to wind up with a new car. That's what's going to happen. Because the lust, how the lust of the eyes work. I see and I stare, I want, I desire, and eventually I have to have. Well, be careful, little eyes, what you see. No, we need to learn like Job, the wisdom of Job, to make a covenant with our eyes that we are simply not going to look where we ought not be looking. And when our eyes occasionally, as will happen in the fallen world, when occasionally our eyes come across something of this world in this age, we will not stare, we will not think, we will not allow it to fester in our minds. No, indeed, the wisdom of the psalmist in Psalm 119 is profound. When in verse 37, he puts it this way. He says, turn my eyes from looking at worthless things and give me life in your ways. Turn my eyes from looking at worthless things. I like the way the psalmist speaks here because of this. He implies that it is impossible for us to go through life not occasionally seeing the worthless thing. It will happen. No, may I always turn my eyes when I come across it. Turn my eyes from looking at worthless things. I can't help the fact that I'm going to see the empty things, the worthless things in life sometimes. The question is, what am I going to stare at? Only looking God's way leads to life. And so sometimes it's not a matter of just looking at things that are morally wrong in themselves. Sometimes it's a matter of looking at worthless things, staring at things that do nothing to benefit us or make us more godlike or bring glory to Him. It's not a matter of sometimes just being sinful. It's a matter of doing righteousness. Oh, in an age when there's so much around us to look at, the TV, internet, all sorts of trash that we could read if we choose to. Even if there are things that are not morally wrong, there are things that serve no purpose. Things that are fundamentally empty and worthless. That waste our God-given time because they neither make us better people or serve others' needs in any way. They are worthless things. And so we need to remember sometimes when it comes to making a covenant with our eyes, it's not just a matter of lust. It's a matter of wasting our God-given precious life and existence on the worthless things of life, staring at things that do nothing of any value from God's perspective, the eternal and permanent things. Because at the end of the day, where you look and what you look at determine what you become. And secondly and finally tonight, going back to the aspect of the eye that is also not just what we see and what we desire, but the eye is something that in a sense filters what we see. Discerns and decides, categorizes what we see. We need to develop a godly vision, to learn to see the way God sees. How do you evaluate, how do you interpret what you see? How do you discern what's good and what's evil in what you see? How do you discern and determine what's valuable and what's not in what you see? I tell you, sometimes we don't even notice what's standing right there in front of us because too often we have not cultivated godly vision. You know, the Jews were so blind they couldn't even recognize their own Messiah when he was literally standing right there in front of them saying, "Listen, I am he." And we roll our eyes and we shake our heads and we say tisk tisk at them for their obliviousness, when the fact of the matter is that it is very hard work to develop vision, to have eyes that see the world and even ourselves the way God does. We may not make the same mistake that the Jews did about Jesus' identity, but we can still very easily make mistakes in seeing the world for what it is, seeing right and wrong accurately, seeing ourselves as we really are, seeing what's valuable and good and true and beautiful and what's not. As Paul put it in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 14, the natural person, the person shaped by the world, does not accept the things of the Spirit of God because they are foolishness to him, and he is not able to understand them. He can't see them for what they really are. Why not, Paul? Because they're spiritually discerned, because that person has never learned to see the way God sees and may not even want to. Paul's point is well illustrated by Jesus in John 5 when he says, "I've come in my Father's name," to the Jews. "I've come in my Father's name. I am he. I'm telling you who I am and where I've come from. I have come in my Father's name and you don't receive me. If another comes in his own name, you'll receive him." You take other people's word about who they are and where they've come from, a much flimsier evidence than me with my miracles. How can you believe them when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? You see each other as credible, but you don't see me, and the Father who stands behind me is the real deal. How does that happen, Jesus asks. No, we have to learn to develop a godly vision if we are going to subdue the lust of the eyes, not just in terms of desiring the wrong things through our eyes, but rightly understanding what our eyes do see, filtering well, discerning well through our eyes. Now, you've heard it so many times. Well, Paul says in Philippians 4, "Finally, my brothers," he says, "whatever is true and honorable, whatever is just, pure, lovely, commendable, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, you think on those things." You stare at that, Paul says. Let that come in through your eyes and simmer in your heart. Turn your eyes away from worthless things and look at the worthy things, the valuable things, the things of substance, and above all, the things that last. So if you were looking for an Old Testament counterpart to the essence of what John is warning us in 1 John about the lust of the eyes, I can't think of anything better than what the wise man said in Proverbs 17. "The discerning sets his face towards wisdom, but the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth." The eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. It's only the fool who trusts his eyes of flesh, unaided by the Word of God, who looks at the world as it is, takes everything for what it's worth, who never asks questions, who never struggles to see clearly, who never says, "What do I yet lack? Where am I blind?" Only the fool does that. Be careful, little eyes, what you see. Be careful, little eyes, how you see. The lust of the eyes, John says. You love the world, you're not of God. If you're here this evening, you're not a child of God this evening, we want to help you with that if we at all possibly can. If you're here this evening, you're not a child of God, but you're familiar with the story, you know the essence of what God has done in history for the salvation of the human race. Jesus of Nazareth, God made flesh, blood shed on the cross for the forgiveness of sins, resurrection to life to give us hope. And you're willing to come forward this evening and confess with your mouth what is in your heart, full faith and assurance that this story is true and that the deeds are effective. And repenting of your sins, that means you're changing how you see the world and your life in it. We'll baptize you for the forgiveness of your sins this evening. You're sitting here, child of God already, but the lust of the world is back in you in some way. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, boastful pride of life. Something, some way from the world has gotten back in you. Pray to God for forgiveness of whatever it is. If we can help you in some way, pray with you, for you. Why don't you come talk to us right now while we stand, while we sing.